Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, and the British lady ushers us into another episode of Murder 123. It's great to be here tonight on a cold Monday night outside in the southeast. Myrtle Beach, it's not so bad here. This is Dr. John Stamey. We've got a bang-up show tonight. I've seldom been so excited to have a very good friend and, of course, two co-hosts that are good friends as well. We're going to have a great time. So tonight, the name of the episode is Murder in the Ring. And I'd like to start by, first of all, ladies first, introducing my co-host for the night, Robin McCray. How are you doing tonight, Robin?
I am doing great. Glad to be here and visit with everybody.
Oh, yeah, we're glad to have you. Now, are you hanging out with your wild African cat?
Absolutely. Absolutely. He's been in here running around, dive bombing me. He gets crazy during this. He must like the show because it seems to be his thing.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to introduce our guest, and then I'm going to ask Robin, since he doesn't know the story of your wild African cat, I'm going to ask you to tell him the story. Our guest tonight is the one and only Papa Stro, the maestro of wrestling, accomplished actor, legend in the wrestling ring with so many NWA franchises and, of course, WCW, and we're just so pleased to have him. He is a wealth of knowledge on wrestling, martial arts, and everything that has to do with physical endurance and being in the ring and doing exhibitions and doing great matches. He's been doing this for pretty much all of his life. Papa Stro, how are you doing tonight?
Doing great, actually. Getting right with some more table reads for a new film I'm going to be at called The Devil Starter, which you'll be on set for pretty soon. And just wrapped up season 3 of the Dust series with a star as a chief in, which has been great. And look, we segue into season 4 sometime at the beginning of next year. So I'm pretty excited for those two projects.
Well, yeah,
that's awesome.
You have thousands of people watching Dusk, don't you?
Oh, yeah, it's growing. Our fan base is growing quite a bit. And this past season has been really great. We've introduced new characters and new story plots and everything. So, this season finale, which just came off this past week, really left the door open for some interesting avenues for season 4. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Well, that's great. And all my heartfelt congratulations go out to Ronald Rossman, who's the producer and writer of Dusk. He does a great job. He's assembled a marvelous cast. I mean, heck, he's got you as a star. He gets an A+ in my book for that. So we're everything.
Me too.
Every success that the two of you have is wonderful for everyone and all your friends, because we are grateful to see you just being so super successful with this and everything. And you had super successful career all your life anyway. Yes, Robin?
Well, on top of the fact that he's got all this talent, let's just put it out there. Papa Stro is probably one of the nicest, sweetest people you will ever meet. Like, I was so fortunate when he came and spent that time at my house, because he's just an absolute sweetheart.
No, thank you so much. You're too kind. Thank you.
Oh, my goodness. Robin, you remind me of...
I freaked you guys out, but...
Oh, thank you. Oh, I had a blast. It was an exciting time. Oh, my gosh. That's a really cool place you have.
Well, I'm going to say...
It's crazy, Bill, but...
You probably had a better time watching me stay scared. But anyway, Robin, I want you to tell Papa Stro about your cat. Is his name still Monster?
No, because the foots had a fit. They don't like me calling anything Monster. They get really offended by it. So we need to take a poll on a great name for an African wildcat. Because
he's
really turning out to be the Murder 123 mascot, because whenever we do this, he is with me, and he's running around the room like a little crazy lunatic, jumping up in the air and landing on my back. He's just as sweet could be. But he was actually given to me by a woman that had him for his first 5 years of his life. He's an African wildcat. He's considered an F1, which means his ancestors are directly from Africa.
Oh, wow.
And he is probably about 25 pounds, maybe a little bit more. He's taller than an average house cat and longer.
He's a real life Lion King.
Yeah, he thinks he is. And I'll tell you what, he's obsessed with sinks. Like, he's sleeping in my sink right now because that's where he feels happy. That's his happy place,
awesome.
Is the sink. Yeah, so my husband no longer has a bathroom sink. But I have this huge, massive bathroom, and it has best acoustics, and it's the quietest place in the house. So whenever I do the podcast, I go in there, and he no longer has to stay in the bathroom. I mean, it's really large. And when we first got him, for him to get used to the noises and the smells of the other animals, he was here. And now we leave it open for him during the day, and he comes and goes as he wants to. But he's obsessed with the sink. And fortunately for me, he picked Pat's side of the sink. So, because we have a double sink. So now Pat doesn't have a sink in the bathroom anymore. And the cat does. But he is an absolute lover. And they kept telling me when I got him, just be careful, because he is an F1. He is an F1, and he can get testy. And I have had exotic cats before, so he wasn't my first, although my first African. And other than when we first got him, we had a lot of problems with him and food, and he just wasn't wanting to eat. And when he did, he was getting sick. And I put him on, he's on a all-meat diet, which is exactly what he's supposed to be on. And he's gaining weight, and he's thriving, and he's full of piss and vinegar all the time now. And he's got a super, super soft fur now.
A true alpha, right?
he is. But he's so comical because when he growls, he sounds like a tiger. He doesn't sound like a house cat. And he'll go to growl at one of the other animals. And it's like they all stare at him like, okay, what the hell are you? And I have this little miniature pig, this little mini piglet, that was also one that was gifted to me because he had had an emotional trauma at a vet's office, and so he couldn't stay where he was. And he's 9 weeks old now, and he's here with me. And he just thinks he owns the house, of course, because he's litter trained. And he will go right up to this cat. Like, he has no fear. And he'll go, and he'll take his snout, and he'll boot him in the butt. And I'm like, you understand, you're his dinner.
Like,
I'm purposely
That's awesome.
Not feeding him pork. So, yeah, it's just, it's crazy here.
That's
it's
great.
Like a zoo at any time, day or night. I mean, it's just mass chaos. So, but he's the mascot. So everybody out there, we need names. We need good African names for this guy. He's absolutely wonderful. His head looks like a cougar. It's got the whole shape and facial structure of a cougar.
Oh, man.
I mean, it's gorgeous. His profile's gorgeous. He's really a pretty guy. So we need a good name. His name is Benji, and I'm sure that was very appropriate. And his mom sounds like a wonderful person that named him that. However, it's just not working here because I keep wanting him to bark. So we are going to officially look for a better name for him. And he's the mascot. Like, he's with us every time we do this show.
Well, Robin, after the show's over, can you please snap a picture so I can put it up on the website and on Facebook so everyone can meet?
I took a picture of him the other day that I absolutely love. I'll send you that one because right behind my bed is actually a tapestry that looks like the woods. Because it makes me calm to think I'm sleeping out in the woods, and I don't have to deal with the bugs that way. And so I have a picture of him sitting there, and his background is the woods. So it turned out really good. So I'll send you that, and then that way you can put that up.
And I'll tell everybody, please send us messages about a great name for this wonderful, wonderful African wildcat. So Papa Stro, now you know the story. She got a real wildcat there, and I like him. He's pretty cool. I met him once, and he didn't. So, I mean, I guess we're still okay. I mean, it just.
He didn't eat anybody. They just keep telling me to be careful of him. And I'm like, he may purr me to death. I'm not sure. But I mean, I can see where he could get pissy, but he's really a good boy.
Aw. That's awesome.
That is great. Well, I tell you what, Robin, thanks for that story, all of our fans. and boy, we have. Now that we have. Our two sponsors, first of all, the Crypto Crew up in Kentucky, they post our show on their site, and we get about 150 about 150 downloads a week now, thanks to the Crypto Crew. We're going to be going up on Vindicated Entertainment here this coming week, and that will open us up to a lot of new fans that just love what we talk about, which is murder. And I got to thank Papa Stro. I got to thank our buddy Greg Bo Watson for giving me this idea.
Okay.
And he said, Yeah. This is Greg Bo, and I'm gonna have Greg Bo on here sometime very soon, because he and his girlfriend Misty are addicted to murder shows. They listen to My Favorite Murder and everything. And he challenged me. He said, "John, you could do that." I said, "Sure, I can." I said, "I'm hanging up and calling you back." So I went and listened to My Favorite Murder, and I said, "I've got a better idea." Because the idea
is
this.
They're really young.
Yeah, we can talk about murder, but so far, every guest that we have had has had a personal connection with the murderer or the victim, and that's kind of our hallmark for what we do. We bring in reality. We bring in, to an extent, personal relationships, and that's something that nobody else is doing, so we're very proud as our fan base is growing for Murder 1-2-3. I just think it's great, and of course, now everybody knows what happened with this show tonight. I come on every week. Now that we're back in the fall, I come on every week at Papa Stro's WCW Retro. By the way, Papa Stro, are you having retro this week because it's Thanksgiving?
Yeah, it's a special Thanksgiving special retro.
All right, good.
So
good. I'll be there. That'll be great. There'll be no scary cast this week, because I'll take this week off from scary cast. But we'll be back, of course, with Murder 1-2-3 next week. So anyway, we were on the show, and I had mentioned it to you a while back. And on the show, I said, "Now, by the way, I've got you down for Murder 1-2-3, and we're going to talk about murder in the ring and some of the infamous stories that have happened." And I was so glad that you were able to carve out this time for it. I think it's important, because you being a professional wrestler, you have known pretty much in the last, 40 years, just about everybody who wrestled. And you've known them all. You've interacted with them. You've wrestled with most of them. If they were around wrestling when you were active, you probably wrestled with them. So we're just grateful to have somebody that is so knowledgeable about the wrestling business. And so tonight, our first story, which will be kind of the majority of the show, we're going to talk about the Chris Benoit double murder suicide, or as some people call it, the triple murder. Now, there's, a lot of information is still unknown about it. I looked around and I couldn't find any investigative records. Next time I'm down in Fayetteville, Georgia, I might just drop by the sheriff's office and see what they have on microfiche that I can take a look at. This Murder 1-2-3 has become quite an adventure to me. Now next weekend, Papa Stro, you'll be in Somerville with us at the Somerville Comic Con, along with Robin and some other folks, and we intend to do a live Murder 1-2-3. We'll invite you to be on that panel if you'd like to be, and we're going to talk about the first serial killer in America, which is Lavinia Fisher of Charleston. Everybody's heard of her. She and her husband operated an inn at the 10-mile mark toward Mount Pleasant in Charleston. And apparently a lot of folks stopped on the way back, to get a night's sleep, have some drinks, and leave and be ready for their journey, and they never made it out alive. So working right now on getting some Robin, it's going to be a wild one. So Lavinia Fisher, that's going to be live, coming to you next Saturday, the December the 7th, from the Somerville Comic-Con. And hopefully we'd love to have Papa Stro join us on that hour. We'll have the scripts out here into this week, and we can all read it and kind of see what's going on with Lavinia. She's quite famous with all the ghost tours in Charleston, but we've uncovered some things that aren't common knowledge about Lavinia Fisher, which I think is important. That's what a little bit of research will do. So tonight, we launch into one of the most interesting stories. I'm such a wrestling fan, and I mean it was great meeting Papa Stro up in Virginia Beach. I was 3 or 4 years ago, and we haven't stopped talking. We really haven't. So now, let me get into the story of Chris Benoit, who was, admittedly, Papa Stro, he was one of the most famous wrestlers that ever lived during his time, wasn't he?
Probably the greatest probably one of the greatest technical professional wrestlers of his era, hands down.
Yeah, he was Canadian, and he ended up working for. Did he work for WCW? Because I don't know, but I know he worked for WWE and WWF. Did he work for WCW?
Yes, he did. He was there for quite some time. Matter of fact, we both tried out for WWE prior, had trial matches prior, and later on we both ended up in WCW. So, yeah, he was there for quite some time and ended up, and right before his run ended with WCW, he became actually WCW heavyweight champ.
I remember
Wow.
when he was in WWE, my boys loved him. I mean, mm-hmm. they went through that phase where everything they did was all about WWE, and they had to have, you know, all the merchandise that went along with the whole WWE experience. You know?
Yeah, he was trained by Bret Hart's dad, Stu Hart, in the Dungeon up in Calgary.
So he's part of that dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
By virtue of being trained, that's wonderful. And you knew the whole Hart family and Chris, and wrestled Chris, didn't you?
Yes, yes. Chris, amazing wrestler. And, you know, I'm very familiar with the Hart family due to years, and in which one of my trainers, Nelson Worrell, was good friends with the old man, Stu Hart. And, yeah, lots of history there. And with Benoit, one of his biggest influences was Dynamite Kid, who was one half of the British Bulldogs at one time, you recall, in WWE.
Yeah, Davey Smith.
His
partner.
Dynamite Kid.
Yep.
Yeah, Davey Boy Smith and Dynamite Kid, British Bulldogs. The Dynamite Kid was a very big influence on Benoit, in which he patterned a lot of his style after Dynamite Kid.
Wow, that's great to know. That's another fact that Papa Stro knows, because he's been in the business. He's wrestled with these people. He's known them. He's traveled with them and everything. So the story goes something like this, at least what you can find out with just some standard research online. In 2007, between June 22nd and June 24th, that's Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Chris Benoit is claimed to have killed his family. On June 22nd, Friday, he's claimed to have killed his wife, Nancy. She was found with a towel wrapped around her head, blood under her head, and her hands and feet tied. A copy of the Bible was left right by her body. Injuries indicated that someone pressed a knee in her back while pulling on a cord around her neck, causing strangulation. Toxicologists, when they examined her blood, found alcohol in her body, along with hydrocodone and alprazolam, which is used to treat anxiety disorders, panic disorders, and anxiety caused by depression. They did not mention to what extent she had those narcotics in her system. Now, a number of wrestlers that the press talked to said that Chris Benoit could have been suffering from repeated concussions that he had gained throughout his wrestling career, ultimately, you know, leading to a really unstable mental state. One of the wrestlers was quoted as saying, "As Benoit was the only guy who would take a chair shot to the back of his head, which is just stupid." Tests conducted on Benoit's brain by a trained neurosurgeon during the autopsy showed that his brain was so severely damaged it resembled the brain of an 85-year-old Alzheimer's patient. Other tests conducted on his brain revealed severe CTE, which is damage of all four lobes of the brain and the brainstem. They concluded that the repeated concussions led to dementia, and that caused severe behavioral problems. So obviously, severe behavioral problems. So anyway, we understand that his wife Nancy was murdered in the upstairs bedrooms, and you know she was, her limbs were bound, and she was wrapped in a towel. So here's my question: this is some ifs, and here's where I need the reasoning of my two panelists, Papa Stro and Robin. The next day, apparently, his son was killed. His son was killed, according to several accounts that I have, to a chokehold that he used to use in wrestling. And they said that his son had a painkiller in his veins so that he was passed out when it happened. Now, if something had happened to the son on Saturday, don't you think if the mother was incapacitated or dead in the bedroom, don't you think a 7-year-old child would have been really antsy to see his mother? I mean, don't you think there would have been some problems with that?
Well, he could have gotten so out of control over what was going on with his mother that that's what ultimately led him, Chris, to go after his son. Because a child of that age, when they're scared, when they're upset and frustrated, they're screaming, they're hollering, they're acting out. You know, they're not sitting there quietly numb. They normally, you know, especially if they want their mommy and they can't get to their mommy, or they see their mom in that state, they're going to be highly agitated and could possibly, not all kids, but I would say a large portion of them would get, you know, could get out of control. And that could have been what led to his demise.
Well, you know, one never knows, but some of the reports said that Chris had given him Xanax and he was completely passed out when the murder occurred. Now, again, all of this assumes that Chris Benoit was the murderer. Then on Sunday, there were some text exchanges between Benoit and several of his wrestling buddies. He had missed a plane and had not gotten to a match in Texas. Now, Papa Stroh, you probably are a little familiar with this. What could you add to this story that you feel would be appropriate and wouldn't be breaching any confidentiality that you have to keep?
Well, first off, Chris and Nancy were very much in love with each other. They were just—I remember at the shows, they were like two kids sneaking off in the back, holding each other and being around each other, and it was cute because I mean I was friends with Chris and Nancy, been so for a while at that point, and I also was friends with Nancy's. Who Nancy was with her prior, which was Kevin Sullivan. And in which guys like myself and Barbarian, we would like get together and like, we felt like we were caught in between, you know, because you know, we were friends with both of them. And, you know, and there was a little tension there at one point, but I mean, they settled their differences, right, with Sullivan and Chris. But it's like Chris and Nancy, I mean, every time I was around them, I mean, they were just very much in love with each other, and the times I've seen him, the son, family, I mean he was great to all of us in the back. Chris was, I mean, heck, I even introduced him to my family. He was very, very respectful, very approachable, and the people that knew Chris, like myself and people who knew him even more than me, like Chris Jericho and a few others that known him for quite a while, he was just a great guy. He just loved the business, very passionate about what he did, and you know, had you know, he gave no inkling to us at all that he had any intentions of doing the horrible tragedy that supposedly went down within him and his family. But with that being said, there's been quite a few reports on that case. You know, there are reports that Nancy was tied up with Bibles placed with her body and his son's body in the house, and with Chris being supposedly hung himself when they were found, right? And Chavo Guerrero, good brother of mine in business, he got to Texas from Benoit about at, you know, like afterwards, right? It was like I think the first text he got to him is like, you know, I love you and all this. And then like the next text he said he got was like, the dogs are in the pen or whatever. And it was like the difference between the two texts were like, it was almost like two different people talking. Right. So, very strange set of circumstances. And there was a point I got too that, Benoit, he was at one of the WWE shows, right? And he got the call from his family about, I really don't know what, but he took a late flight back home that weekend, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was like an emergency or something, and that's another report I got with that. So it just the way a lot of us knew him. I mean, the way that he did not give any vibe at all about being capable of doing any of those horrid things.
Well, I was going to ask you because it says that when they the autopsy from the brain trauma that he had from the wrestling, they were claiming that he would be like, you know, an 80-odd-year-old Alzheimer patient or dementia. And mm-hmm. I have had dealings with people that have had Alzheimer's or dementia, and they can get out of control, and they don't realize they're out of control, but they can. And I guess, because I do have a couple questions I want to ask you, because I think you're probably the closest person we'd be able to talk to that knew him personally. And there was no indication that he had any brain injuries at all? I mean, did he act like, you know, he was just as normal as everybody else? He's like, there was nothing wrong with him as far as the brain injury?
Well, here's some of the point about with that scenario. Vince McMahon actually said it best. Honestly, he said if his brain had that much trauma, it would have really affected him in his travels, because he wouldn't be able to go to and from the airport, get his rental car, go to the town. You know what I mean?
I mean, I'm shocked that for somebody that had supposedly, and I say supposedly because we don't know, that much trauma. I mean, I've seen people with a third of that trauma and seen how they are. And it was so noticeable. I mean, I don't understand how anybody could have that much trauma to the brain and it be undetected in their day-to-day life and their behaviorism. That just, to me, is appalling that nobody could pick that up for that kind of damage, if indeed he had the damage that was described.
Right. Oh, yeah. So, for him to do what he did, I mean, there's just, if he had that type of trauma, there's no way he could be traveling.
Well, that's what I thought. And the other thing I wanted to ask you, and I really thought this was so odd, are the thing with the Bible. Now, was he a particularly religious person?
Well, he never really talked religion around me, you know what I mean? I mean, because we're like all business. Permits, but I mean, very cordial, but we just never got on those topics.
Yeah. I just thought that was really kind of telling. I mean, it was almost like whoever did this, and I'm not going to say that Chris did it or Chris didn't, because obviously I was not there, but I think we should never presume anything just because, you know, he was found hung, because I think if we look back at different cases, that doesn't mean that he did it. You know, it could mean that anybody else did it and hung him. So, I mean, in all fairness to his memory, I think we need to not lose sight of that. But when you see that there's two Bibles down there, it's almost like whoever did this then turned around and, as an act of kindness, thought that was going to give comfort in some way. You know what I mean?
I'm with you. I got a couple theories myself, honestly, from hearing it. I tell you, I was talking to one of my buddies in the business afterwards. And, of course, there were some people that threw the scenario about Kevin Sullivan having some, which was ridiculous. I mean, Kevin loved Nancy. There's no way. And, you know, he respected the fact, I mean, him and Chris had their differences, but they, you know, he respected the fact that they were together. And, you know, Kevin isn't that type of guy whatsoever. But, I tell my buddy about this, right? What happened with Chris and Nancy and his son. And the first thing he said to me, he said, "That sounds like a hit."
Yeah, you know what? I hate to say it, but I'm not convinced that Chris did it. I'm sorry. I'm just not.
Because the media was quick to say he did it and all this, and said, oh, he did this, he did that, whatever. And they pretty much tried to sweep it under the rug. And you had some people on television that didn't even know the guy, didn't even know Chris, was pretty much throwing him under the bus verbally, right? And which was upsetting a lot of people, like Hugh Morris, Bill DeMott, Chris Jericho, that knew him, you know, they were upset because the fact that these other people were saying all this and that about Chris, and they didn't even know the guy. He had no clue about the guy, and they immediately thought he was, you know, all bad and all evil and all this. So it was just
Another thing that I thought very odd, and I could be completely off on this because I'm not even going to lie, my kids were so in love with the WWE. I didn't follow it as close as I should. It was just one more of those things that my boys were doing and doing the wrestling moves on each other, which, by the way, when children do that, they can dislocate their shoulder. But besides that, you don't know how many emergency room trips we went to. But anyway, the thing is that I don't recall at that time period – reading anything in the paper about him being a violent person. And
no.
I mean, and I could have missed it because I, like I said, I wasn't specifically looking for it at that time, but I don't recall hearing even anything about how he was beating up his wife or he was hurting his children or all these other things that you would presume would be part of a pattern before somebody lost it to that degree.
Right. And
but yet, you know, when you saw them, they were completely in love with each other.
Yes, yes, very much so. I mean, it was just, it was kind of cute, actually. They were like two kids, you know, falling in love with each other, like crushing on each other. It was really cool. But it's I don't know, you know, I wasn't there, obviously. I don't know what really went down, but in my heart of hearts, I really don't think he did it whatsoever. I really think he just made someone upset and they're out to disgrace him.
Well, and I'm going to be honest with you. You know, I usually get vibes on things. And I wasn't there. Just like you said, Papa, I wasn't there. I'm not going to tell you 100% he did or didn't because I wasn't there to physically see what went on. But going by the facts and just my own thought process, I have to agree 100% with you. I don't feel that he did this. I feel it was set up to look like he did, and that this poor woman and this poor child were sacrificed to ruin Chris's memory or a payback that somebody felt was owed to them, and the only way to hurt Chris was to destroy the things that he loved the most.
Right.
You know, and I could be wrong, but I'm just saying that that's my thoughts on it.
I mean, I know, you know, we know couples argue, right? I mean, that's
that's normal.
You know, but
They don't kill each other.
With that, no, not at that level. And then the child, I mean, you can't tell me he wanted to kill his son, really.
I just don't buy that. I just don't buy that. And that's the other thing. I never saw or heard anything about him being abusive to his children. Abusive to his wife, and there may be things out there about it that I didn't see because at the time I wasn't looking for it. But, you know, I just have a hard time wrapping my head around it. I just think that this is a giant cover-up.
And think this, too. Didn't they say the child didn't have any bruises on him when they found him? I mean,
except
Chris
around his neck. That's what one of the reports said.
That's what I heard. I heard the kid didn't have any marks. I heard the kid didn't have any marks around him. And I'm, you know, Chris is a strong guy. And you would know, I mean, just the whole thing just with him and Nancy being tied up and actually being tied up in a chair is what I heard.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is, you know, news aside, if anything was going on that you would hear on the outside, you physically met these people. Okay. If he was an abusive father, you can tell if a child is around somebody that abuses them. They react differently. They don't just run up and say, hey, Dad, and act perfectly normal. They're withdrawn.
Right.
They pull away. They try to stay in the other side of the room. They try to be as quiet as possible to kind of blend into the woodwork so they don't get attacked. You know, I think that would be something that you would have noticed.
Oh, absolutely. And he was the top of his game. I mean, he was, you know, regularly with WWE at the time, and I mean, he was doing very well for himself. He was on television every week, and in the best shape of his life. It just, with all that going for him and his family, you wouldn't think all the trouble. I mean, you wouldn't think that tragedy would have went down the way it did.
Exactly. Yeah, I have to really agree with you. I do.
Well, that's one reason that I introduced this this show as the double murder suicide or the triple murder, because I have never thought, ever since I heard about this, I just internally never thought that he did it. That I thought the whole thing was, as Kevin Sullivan said, it was a setup. It was a hit job. And what worse way to discredit somebody and try to remove their name from everything in broadcasting and everything in a sport like wrestling is to off the two people they love the most, his wife and his son, and then get rid of him. I mean, that's exactly how you try to erase the memory of somebody, and it's just so sad.
It put a black mark on the whole business there for a while, you know what I mean? It really put a black mark on the whole business.
The other thing that I find really suspect is when Chavo Guerrero got the voicemail from Benet, from Chris, okay? He said he overslept, he missed his flight. How often was that a normal thing for him to be late for a gig? I mean, really? He's a professional.
That was his life.
So first he's late for this, which he normally wouldn't have been. And then the Chavo guy says that, you know, he called him back and found Chris sounded tired and groggy. That doesn't make sense to me. That, to me, is an indication that somebody had drugged him, whether something was put in something he ate or drank, or I don't care how you put it down. He was groggy. I have a hard time with it. And if you wake up, let's say you're running late for work, okay? You wake up, you realize you're late, you are cold stone sober, and you are in a hot minute. You are not tired and groggy. You are jumping up, and you're agitated, and you're wired, and you're trying to get out that door because you know you're late. You're not tired and groggy.
Mm-hmm.
Because the adrenaline of realizing that you're late for work has just snapped you like you just took a cold ice shower. So none of that felt normal to me.
It doesn't add up. I mean, I guess you go back to the doctors.
Yeah.
I mean, and look at the track record. I mean, honestly, look at the track record of some of these doctors with these performers. Not just for wrestling, but like with Elvis and Michael Jackson. I mean, and a lot of their passing goes back to the doctors and what they were prescribing them.
Exactly. But then if you go down and you look into this more, it says that Chris got hold of Chavo, however you pronounce it, I'm sorry, and said
Chavo,
he had a stressful day because Nancy and Daniel were homesick from food poisoning, another thing that could have shown signs of if they were all being drugged.
Right. That's true.
This is what I'm saying. It goes so much deeper than what they show on the surface. And you're talking about he's missing a flight for work, and he's groggy instead of being wide awake, and then all of a sudden they're down with food poisoning. None of that makes sense to me. And to me, that sounds like somebody that family that's been drugged or had some type of, you know, contaminant
something
that either made them sick or something.
Yeah.
That was not them
Chris
normal
was the
person.
Yeah, Chris was the picture of perfect health. I mean, he would work out all the time. So,
I mean,
it doesn't add up.
Papa, there was a remark in two of the stories that I read that said Chris drank very heavily. I get the impression you can't do that and be at the level that he was at. Is that correct?
Well, you know what? He didn't drink no more a lot of other people did in the back in the business that did. I mean, it was just like, you know, the flares, the, but I mean, I've never seen it affect him to the point where it prevented him from doing what he had to do. Cause I mean, we go and hang out in the lounges at the hotels and so forth. And he had a few drinks and he goes to bed and gets up, works out in the gym and flies to the next town and performs that night. So,
but it also says that Nancy was vomiting blood and Daniel was also vomiting. Okay, if you just have the flu or food poisoning, you're not throwing up blood. You get that when you've ingested something that has caused such trauma to your insides that you're vomiting the blood. Again,
that's
I hate
poison,
to sound like a broken
right?
record, you guys, That to me sounds like they have. It's all been tampered.
Right. That sounds like poisoning there.
Yeah.
Well, they talked about in Nancy, she had alcohol, she had hydrocodone, and she had basically a muscle relaxer. And it said that they did not talk about the level in her blood. Now, you know that when they did the autopsy, they got the level in those in her blood. And I think it might not be a bad idea the next time I'm in Atlanta is to run over to Fayetteville, Georgia, and see if through the Freedom of Information Act that I can't get a copy of the autopsy report. I mean,
well, yeah, and how
I guess,
does she get all that in her system when she's vomiting even blood?
Right.
I mean, is stuff going in or is stuff coming out?
Well, it's like this is like another investigation. You know, once we start talking about it, you realize we need to take a look at some of this because our experience years later can certainly shed some light on something that happened back then. They were maybe too close to it to think of it.
Absolutely. It talks about these text messages were sent to coworkers between 3:51 and 3:58 using their phones. That doesn't mean anything. Anybody can pick up someone's phone and do it.
I mean
whoever did this crime could have picked up their phone and sent text messages on their behalf. That doesn't mean Chris and Nancy sent them.
Right. And who's to say that when Chris arrived, went back home, they were waiting for him. They've already did the damage.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And they have a gun at his head.
And
then they have a gun at his head and say, you say this or you're gone. And at that point, he's hoping that maybe he can get out alive, so he'll just say whatever they told him to say. And also,
And Chris is a strong guy. Chris is a strong guy. So, I mean, it had to be more than one person that done all the damage.
Or they could have been threatening that if you don't do this, we will kill your wife, even though they did it anyway. He could have done it trying to spare his wife. But then when you look at this, and it goes into more detail about how he had called the talent relations office to let him know he was going to take a later flight. Okay, if you're going to do the things that they claim he did, you're not going to be that coherent where you're going to call and let them know you're still coming, but you're taking another flight. You know
right.
what I mean? You might call and say, I'm on my way now to cover yourself, but you're not going to say, I'm still here, and I'll take a flight later, because that puts you at the scene of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to try to come on and say that you're not there to prove you're innocent. The whole thing is just very suspect.
It really is. And Dave just swept this under the rug way too quick for my taste when it went down.
Yeah. Wow. I think this has been some very, very good discussion about an incident that happened, 12 and a half years ago.
Yeah.
And it might be that everybody was too close to see what was going on. But with Papa Stroh, who knew Chris,
right. It's like, this could be very much a possibility for sure. I mean, I know we weren't there enough, but the Chris Benoit that I knew and respected and stuff, he would never have done any of this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
So something was wrong somewhere. You know what I mean?
Well, Chris is saying thanks for the vote of confidence, and I think all three of us have a vote of confidence for him because it's not right. There's something about this.
It's not making sense to me.
It stinks to high heaven, and Chris is listening to us, I'm sure, and he knows that. We're on his side, and I don't believe we're wrong. I don't. So that's what I can say about our discussion about Chris Benoit. Well, I tell you what, our buddy Tony Filosi has come on, and he's going to chat a little bit about the cell block for about 10 or 15 minutes. And then Papa Stroh, a couple more names I would like to ask you about when we come back in Tony's spot and see what you think, see what you know, because it's fascinating to have somebody that is in the business, not was, but is in the business. You've been trained by the best. You've wrestled the best. You know them. You hung out with them, and your knowledge is just so valuable. when we talk about this, and the people listening to us can get a real firsthand experience about what were these people like. So first, thanks for part one, and we're going to talk to Tony for a little bit, then we'll be back for part two in a little bit. Tony Filosi, how is everything up in Harlan, Kentucky?
It is going just wonderful, John. It's a fantastic show. I've been listening to the show, John Robbins, Papa Strode. This is an unbelievable show. It's great.
Tony, we love you.
Thank you.
Thank you. What we have from Harlan County tonight is we want to talk a little bit about a gentleman named Bill Lewis. I'm going to set the stage for you. It's 1937. You had the coal mine wars going on. You had the union versus the company. You have a big push that is starting against the union organizations of Harlan County of the labor force. There were union organizers that were besieged in a local hotel. The name of it was the Llewellyn Hotel. Now, in order to get those fellows out, there were calls made to the governor, and he dispatched National Guardsmen in order to get those fellows out alive. Now, during this time, there were cars and homes dynamited. Organizers were beaten and ambushed by deputies. Now, back in those days, a sheriff's deputy usually had a side job as a company policeman. They were all part of, they were all, the sheriff and the deputies were all really on the payroll of the coal company. And that's how they got away with this. So the sheriff was in on it. He wasn't trying to uphold the law or prevent any of this violence. Now, in April of 1937, Bill Lewis and some of his cronies that were also deputies, they were in a place called Verda where there was a union organizer, two brothers, Lloyd and Jasper Klaus. They were there talking to some miners about joining the union early that morning. As they left a saloon, that's technical jargon for speakeasy, or it's not really a Western type of saloon. It's more of a roadhouse. These guys came, they saw them come out of the saloon. They accosted them on the street, told them to throw up their hands. They wanted to search them. As the gentleman turned around, as the brothers turned around, the deputies drew their pistols and shot Lloyd Klaus down. He was the main organizer. His brother Jasper was just with him kind of as a support and learning the business. So they were really after Lloyd. They gunned him down and pistol whipped his brother about to death. So when his brother came to, he was laying in a muddy street next to his brother's dead body. Now,
wow.
So the deputies, none of the deputies were charged in the murder. About 10 days later, Jasper Klaus and some others testified before the Senate Civil Liberties Committee in Washington, D.C. about the mine violence in Harlan, Kentucky. Whenever they got back, there was threats made against their lives by a fellow named Pearl Basham, and they had to leave town. They had to move to the next county over. Jasper took his brother's family and moved them about 30, 40 miles away. Bill Lewis lived on until 1942. Bill Lewis, in November of 1942, was guarding ballot boxes in the old Harlan County Courthouse. He was working the third shift. About 1:20 a.m., he came back from getting dinner. And from underneath the stairwell, a fellow stepped out and shot Bill 5 times in the chest and the stomach, killing him almost instantly. No suspects were ever found, and nobody seen anything. Now, what's interesting about this is that a fellow that we're going to talk about some later, Manzo Shepherd, and his friend Sherman Klaus and his sister Mary Klaus come into play. They were the children of Lloyd Klaus that was killed in 1937. Within 10 days of Bill Lewis being assassinated, Mary Klaus married one of Manzo Shepherd's brothers. And within 6 months after this murder, they committed a murder on top of Black Mountain that we'll talk about later. That was one of the most sensational crimes and trials in Harlan County history.
Well, probably in all of Kentucky. And just so that everybody knows, Manzo Shepherd was shot in the middle of the courtroom. You told that story on ScaryCast. It was fascinating, and I'm glad we're going to be able to revisit that. It's truly one of the most horrific incidences in all of Kentucky from some of my research, Tony, and we're so grateful that you've been doing research on that and you can fill us in. And I'll turn it back over. I just had to commend you for weaving all these things together, and you're going to have them in a book for us in spring, aren't you?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, by spring. I'm working on the book. I'm actually doing some more research on it as we speak, tying some of these. I'm actually in contact with Manzo Shepherd's niece, his actual niece. His sister, her name is Kathy Swabble. She's from Ohio. She was born late in life to Manzo's baby sister, the youngest of the girls. So Kathy and I are talking back and forth, and she's giving me some great insights into the family. And let me tell you, they were one rough bunch.
Yeah. Mm. I believe
that. Wow. Well, that's some amazing stuff. And, you know, it's funny, it happens in one of the smallest towns in Kentucky, Harlan, Kentucky. But you've had some amazing things happen in that little town, haven't you, Tony?
Oh yes, the mine wars, they were a lot more violent than what people what made the papers. There were a lot more murders that didn't make the papers. A common tactic to shut down organizers or somebody that was joining the union, they would blow off their front porch with dynamite.
Oh,
and
wow.
that was the warning. Mm. Second time they blew the home up.
Well, it sounds like they covered up a lot in that town.
Very much. And I I'll only be able to scratch the surface because most of those folks that were in that are gone. But I do actually have some firsthand accounts. I got to work with a lady that was one of the oldest mayors in the state of Kentucky. She was the mayor of Benham, which is a small town about 25 miles from here. She was a young child whenever there was some of these battles going on, and they actually had a battle outside of Benham, the Benham school, between union and company men. There was a commissary that was probably 300 yards, 250, 300 yards from the school. The school sits up on a hill. And you come down the hill, then there's the main highway, then there's the company store. And they had a machine gun mounted on top of the company store. Now, what people don't realize is a lot of times when these organizers, when the union come in, it wasn't with two or three carloads. When they were doing a big push, it could be 50 to 75 cars, and they would go to a couple different mine sites in a day. So they were in school, and this was going on, and there was a gentleman that was sitting on the side of the road in a vehicle when they were, the shooting started, and he got hit by a stray bullet, and was, when the battle broke out, the teacher got to go back to the school, got him down. But that fella, that unfortunate soul, he lay there for hours in the vehicle, and no help to get to him. He was probably dead. Being shot through the throat. But that was, there were some pretty heinous things that happened in those days.
Wow. Well, Tony, thank you for that report from Harlan, Kentucky, because we know that that ties right into the famous Manzo Shepherd murder. And what we need to do is maybe next week we might just have you on here, not let you do the cell block, but have you on as our guest and kind of do a whole panorama of Harlan County and leading up to the Manzo Shepherd murder, you know, with some of this information. Would you be glad to be our guest for the whole show next week?
Oh, absolutely. I would love to.
Well, good. Well, we'll postpone the cell block next week, and you'll be our guest for 90 minutes, and we'll hear more about, and I need to interview you to get some notes up for people to see so that they kind of understand who the players are. It does get kind of confusing, but I was following it, and look, great reporting. And next week we're going to turn, we'll be interviewing you, and you'll have the whole show to tell us all about what all happened between, like, basically 1930 and the mid 40s in Harlan that led up to the death of Manzo Shepherd. And
that's a great job you're doing, Tony. You are just killing it with that. I mean, excuse the pun, but you really are.
Okay, no pun intended. But
I know I said that, and I went, wait a minute.
Robin, I'm murdering it.
You're murdering it. That's right.
Murdering.
Okay. Well,
hey, I am still really geeked up and excited to come to Kentucky and go through these buildings with you. I'm like counting on it. I'm so excited about that.
I have a story, which, you know, because I don't want to hold up, the Crispin Wall thing, but man, because that's super interesting. But there was some crazy stuff happening in the mines I was telling you guys about, the haunted mines. So it was this past weekend.
Well, that's great. We're going to turn the whole show over to you next Monday night. And I need to interview you briefly so that we can get some of this down. I want people to start seeing the same notes that we all have. So that's going to be great. And thanks. So, Tony, we want you to join us now. I got some more questions. I have one observation about Chris Benoit. Then I've got some questions for Papa Stro about some folks that he probably knows and all that. But I will say this. That towel that they found wrapped around Nancy Benoit's head, did they do a DNA analysis of it? And because if it was a towel in their house, the likelihood that there was any DNA that was not Nancy's, that was not Chris's, or not son Daniel's, the likelihood of any additional DNA is just about zero, as much as towels get washed in hot water. And I think it would be a smart thing if a DNA study was done on that, if they still have it, and certainly they probably do. Again, that's something that I can get with the Freedom of Information Act, at least find out if they've got it, and
I want to know if they, you know, do they check under their fingernails for DNA? I mean, that's a very common thing. You know, when somebody's fighting, they're fighting to get them away, and especially women. Okay, I would love to say that I never get anything under my fingernails. It drives me crazy. But in this case, it would be helpful, even a child.
And then it would be interesting to know if they treated it as a suicide scene or they treated it as a possible murder scene. Did they dust for prints on the phones? Did they, like you guys were talking about the towel, did they check the towel for, you know, somebody strangling, pushing the, has a towel over your head, especially if they're a male, that you're probably going to drop some hair or some sort of DNA evidence there. How did they treat it? Was it straight up and down? Did they treat it like a suicide and case closed? or did they just for print, kind of check and make sure that you know, there was not any foul play?
Well, Papa Stroh, let me ask you this. You Papa Stroh, you made the remark that this thing got shut down very quickly, didn't it?
Very much so.
Would you say like within a week or two it was gone?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I just think that there's just too many things that don't add up.
Yeah, two weeks is not enough time to do all the work they need to. But then again, it's 2007. That's 12 to 13 years ago. And maybe they weren't thinking DNA evidence back then like we do today. That's all we think about, and that really does help solve crimes. So, you know, that's just something, again, I can certainly get access to the unless they were sealed by the court. I mean, the Freedom of Information Act will allow us to get copies of everything, including the autopsy. So I'll see next time I'm down in Atlanta. I'll see what gives over there and see if we can get it. And if I can find them, I will circulate them to the hosts, to Papa Stroh, and we'll reconvene on this in a couple months if I can
definitely.
So Papa Stroh, if I can get the autopsy, can I get you a report and you'll join us back on that one?
Sure.
That's great. I couldn't imagine a more interesting thing than if we can do that. Now, Papa Stroh, I got a couple more names that I want to pass by you. A couple more incidences. You know, I'm sure you knew Bruiser Brody, right?
One of my first influences in wrestling, actually. He was the guy that when I was younger, when I first saw him, I kept calling him Blackbeard because I had a thing for pirates back then. He would get kicked out of me calling him Blackbeard whenever I saw him, right? But
absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, he was amazing wrestler, amazing.
And what he got murdered in Puerto Rico, didn't he?
Yep, sure did.
Do you recall? Now, by the way, everybody, Pop Stroh has not had any prep on this. Do you know much about what happened to him?
From what I recall, him and another wrestler got in an altercation, and then next thing you know, Brody's in the shower washing up after his match, and then the other guy comes up and murders him right there.
Yeah,
that's
Jose Gonzalez.
Yes.
Yep.
And years later, he ended up booking for the company.
Who, Gonzalez?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Ooh. Okay.
Yeah.
By the company,
talking
about which company?
Down in Puerto Rico. The wrestling company that they were with.
Good
at the
Lord.
Time. And,
good Lord.
And, this, you know, the story, I was actually there when it happened, but these are accounts I've gotten from, you know, Tony Atlas that was there when he saw it go down. Dutch Mantel was very familiar with it. A few other people, some of the people in the business. And which I still see his wife every now and then, Bruiser Brody's wife, at the CAC once a year at Vegas. Yeah, very nice lady.
Wow.
Tony Atlas had given a statement, but then when it came time, he just stayed silent and Gonzalez walked.
Yeah, it's very it's very, very crazy set of circumstances down there. It was very apparent what happened and when it went down, but through light of, I guess, under the table negotiating, you know.
Exactly. I was just going to say money talks.
It sure does.
And you're in a foreign country when you're in Puerto Rico. I don't care what they say. That's not the U.S.
It's just like what Chris Tucker said to Jackie Chan in Rush Hour 2. He says, follow the rich man.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well put, Papa. Well put. All right. Well, that
right.
that solves that one. So that's Bruiser Brody. Now, Vern Gagne, after his career and he was in a rest home, does that ring a bell? Does that ring a bell?
Oh, is this the incident where he body slammed the guy in a rest home?
Yeah. His roommate.
Yeah, yeah. You see, well, his mind was going bye-bye, basically, and I guess he had a sudden relapse of past memories, and body slammed.
Thought he was back in the ring.
Yeah.
Yeah, he body slammed the guy, and apparently he died. Yeah, very.
In his day, Vern Gagne was one of the toughest around. I mean, matter of fact, he had his own school. He taught people, and he was very instrumental with teaching some of the greats going today. You know, like Ric Flair, Ken Patera, and a host of others. That went. I think Steamboat went. I'm not sure about maybe so, but I know Flair and Patera definitely went through, you know, his training camp. And Patera was like. If you recall Ken Patera, he was like in the ABC Wild World of Sports. He was like known as the world's strongest man before, you know, Mark Henry came along. Did all the powerlifting competitions.
Wow.
They showed him an ABC Wild World of Sports intro quite a bit back in the day, back in the 70s.
Oh, he was the guy doing the cling and jerk with that million pounds, right?
That was him.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. Huh.
Boy, the only person up to wrestle him would have been Andre the Giant.
Yeah.
Oh, Papa, I revert to your stories. Can you please share your meeting Andre the Giant story with Tony and Robin? It is a priceless story. Do you mind sharing
that?
Oh,
my God. Well, to this day, Andre the Giant has to be the biggest human being I've ever seen in my entire life. I was down in Florida. At one of the wrestling shows, right? Because my aunt and uncle lived in Tampa, and some of the guys I would see down there, like Dusty Rhodes and a few others, you know, Gordon Soley and all that. And then one time on one of the shows, I saw Andre the Giant come in the parking lot. His head and shoulders were above the car while he's driving. He had the sunroof, right? And I was just so freaked out. I guess he just got upset for the $6 million man at the series when he was playing the Bionic Bigfoot, if you remember.
Yeah.
Lee Majors. Well, he walks out of the car, right? And he's coming towards me, and I'm so scared. You know how you're so scared you can't move? You're petrified, right? and I really, for the first time in my life at that point, I thought another human being was going to eat me because he was a huge.
Oh, wow.
And Dusty Rhodes
God.
At the time came over, right? And at the time, I thought he saved my life, but he was just breaking the ice. I mean, Andre is like, hey, kids, don't worry about a thing. Andre is cool, baby. Say hello, Andre, right? And that's how Dusty talks. And Andre takes his hand down to me and looks down at me and says, how do you do, right? And I went to shake his hand, and my hand just disappeared. Because his hand is engulfed. I couldn't even see my hand. And I'm like, fine, sir. How you doing, right? And he was actually really nice. But at the time, before Dusty, you know, introduced us, I really thought it was going to be his dinner that night. Seriously.
We need DNA done on Andre the Giant.
Oh, my God. Amazing. But such a great guy, though. He was such a cool dude.
How do you do?
That's awesome.
And you're looking and you're thinking, yeah. I don't know. I'm trying not to be your dinner.
Yeah, right.
Time, sir.
Oh, that's
oh,
great.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, the great stories you've got.
Feet. Please don't eat me.
Right.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
He could eat. That guy had appetite on him. Oh, my. And drink, you know, he's French. He loves his wine, you know, and beer.
Yeah, oh my gosh.
He was getting the box of wine, and that was his appetizer, I'm sure. I mean, my Lord. But anyway, well,
if you're friends with him, you're in good. You had nothing to worry about.
You're, sa- You're safe. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now comes the final story, because you know that you know details about this story. I can't quite remember. I got a phone call from the Italian Stallion at 6 o'clock in the morning. This was 20 some years ago, and he was telling me about Owen Hart dying, because I hadn't heard. I just hadn't heard the news and everything, and I know that you were in tight with the Hart family. And do you mind sharing your recollection of what all happened with Owen Hart? Do you mind doing that? Because I know he was a friend of yours, and sometimes it's hard to talk about things like that. Would you mind doing that?
Sure, I loved Owen. Owen was great. Owen was such a down-to-earth guy. I mean, he would like sit like with us right now and just talk and shoot the breeze and joke and kid. I remember one time we pulled the rib on King Kong Bundy after Monday Night Raw. we're driving back to the hotel. We just dropped off Sid and Bertha Faye, Sid Vicious, and we're going to drop off Bundy, and we're in this van, right? I'm driving, and Owen's in the passenger side, and Bundy's in the back, and he walks to the back of the van to pick his bags, right? Well, you know, it's raining down in Jonestown, PA, right? I think we're at Jonestown. And Owen elbows me, right, and says, "Floor it." I'm like, "What?" He says, "Floor it, man." Like, okay, so I take off, and the bag's dumped on Bundy, and here's this big, beefy man, King Kong Bundy, chasing us around the parking lot, cussing at us, right? And I'm like, "Oh, my God." And Owen is like laughing his butt off. Oh my God, it's crazy. And then, like a few years later, afterwards, I was in a wrestling event up Northern Virginia, I think, and Bundy was on the card, and I'm sitting in the back, and Bundy comes up to me like, "Oh God, he's going to kill me, right?" And he puts his arm around me, started laughing, and he tells me, he knew that Owen had put me up to the rib, right? So it was funny stuff. But with Owen, I guess. Well, this was the time when he was kind of doing the whole Blue Blazer thing, the whole Masked Man Blue Blazer thing in WWE. And he would do entrances where he would come out of the top of the building to the ring with the harness for the cable, pretty much similar to what years later what Sting would be doing with WCW. He would come out of the wrap through the whole Sting Crow bit, right, from the movie The Crow. And I did it too with the maestro coming out of the rafters playing the baby grand piano. I had the harness, which I worked with stunt people like a couple weeks prior to start doing it regularly with them entrances. And with Owen, something happened, and I forget the name of the pay-per-view offhand, but something happened to where he was doing his usual entrance with the Blue Blazer, right? And something happened where the harness actually released. And if anybody knows anything about those harnesses, they are strong. And once they're locked, I mean, unless you manually unlock it, there's no way. I mean, it will hold a lot of weight.
And then
right?
Somebody tampered with it.
And when that thing released, he fell down to the ring. And I think he got caught. So the report saying he got caught in the ropes on his way down, and that's what pretty much did it. Was the length of the fall, and this was during the time. It was like the look on. I think it was Jim Ross and Jerry the King Lawler doing commentary, and the look on their faces, because I think they just took a little break away, and then when they came back, and during that break, I think it's when it actually happened, and when they came back on live, and they were the look on their faces, man, and this was right at the start of the pay-per-view, right? And believe it or not, they continued with this pay-per-view even after the tragedy happened, which was I don't know. That's wow. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I could have done it myself. You know, I know some people that would say, "Yeah, oh, just that would Owen would have wanted the show must go on and everything." But I mean, like that night, the rest of the you could see the look on the talent's faces, and everyone a part of that whole show was like, "Whew!" And even the next night, I think on Raw, was like they were all crying, and you know, I mean, it was just it was just terrible. And but I know on the other side of the fence, I was on the other side, but WCW at the time, and seeing what happened, you know, seeing that, how it affected Brett, and he came out and made a big speech about it, and which I've never, at that point, I've never seen Brett in that mental state like he was. And I know it had to have been tough to make the speech that he did, but, man, just, it just dragged every, I mean, it just put a damper on the whole business during that time. And I remember, it wasn't long after that Rick Rude passed away, right? Perhaps Rick Rude, if you remember him.
Yeah,
absolutely. He was good friends with Jim Hennig, Mr. Perfect. He was known as Mr. Perfect in WWE and all that. Well, we're on WCW at the time. I remember sitting in a room, and I had lost the lady I was going to marry at the time, Leanne, who was also in the wrestling business, actually. I remember her and Lana Kai were actually twins. They could pass for twin sisters. I mean, look, Lana Kai was training her, and she loved her to death. And we're all three sitting in this room, right, talking about our losses. You know what I mean? With Rick Rude and Owen and Leanne, and even though it was like the saddest of times, it kind of brought us more together, our friendship together.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, But Owen was one of the good guys in the business. I mean, Owen was a great family man. And I know there for a while, because of the Owen tragedy, Owen's wife had some big issues with WWE at the time, and the whole Hart family in general for a bit. So it took time for that bridge to mend. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's one of those unexplained things with the harness, because I've been, like I said, I've trained with stunt people that helped me with the harnesses for those type of entrances, because I had to learn to propel myself at one point down to the arena floor from the top of the arenas, right? And and I'm not much on height, trust me. So
I can't stand on my kitchen counter, okay?
Right? So it was a big step for me, right? But once the stuntman showed me how to do it, I felt a lot much safer, you know, with that harness. Because that harness, I remember one time one of those harnesses, I did one of my entrances, right? And I'd always release it from my tights, because it was hooked to my tights as I was coming down playing the piano, right? And I always would release it before I'd get to the ring to wrestle, right? Well, one time it stuck to my tights, right? So I'm having to walk in the ring with this harness on my lower back. So every time I would roll around the mat and do anything in the ring, it would just, the steel harness would like jam my backside. I'm like, oh, God.
Oh, my God.
Please get this match over with. So
yeah. That would
but
be
those
awful.
Things are hard. Oh, brutal. So I'm cringing on live TV, right? The whole time I'm cringing,
oh,
I'm really cringing. I'm biting my tongue, you know. But, it's just one of those things, man, where with a harness like that, as tight as it's locked, I mean, and Owen, for that to release on him like that in midair.
Well, Papa Stro,
who
would have put the harness on him? Would it have been one of the stunt people who knows exactly how it works, or just a stagehand?
Would
have put it on Owen?
Yeah, because they have a whole crew in the back to take care of everything. You know, the stunt people with that. They got the technical people to handle all the technical stuff, and they even have doctors in the back to check on us, right? And get everything. I mean, the whole setup. And it was just, man, so weird. I mean, for a harness like that to release right during that.
Well, did they
ever
think that somebody tampered with it, or was it just a truly just malfunction?
I know it's been investigated. They've looked into it, and I guess I mean, the conclusion was it was just a malfunction, right? It was just one of those rare occurrences, right? So sad.
That's
too bad. I mean,
we lost
a great person, great human being.
Yeah.
And so.
And that's the sad thing. I mean, these are not just people that entertain us and wrestle. These are human beings. They have people that love them. They have people that care about them. They have families. They have friends. You know, it's just not the persona you see on TV. There's a whole lot more to them.
Right. It's, I mean, we're human too. I mean, it's just like
we're just
making a living doing what we love, right?
Yeah.
That's right. Producing Murder 123, just something I love because we get to talk to folks like you, like Papa Stroh, and we find out things that people just don't know because they haven't been in the business like you have. And it has truly been a privilege to have you on here. Yeah, Robin, go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt, John.
No, that was just an early thank you to Papa Stroh for being here with us. Yeah, go ahead, Robin.
I just want to tell him that the person that will be up in the middle of the night on YouTube looking for you and your tights coming down on the harness, that will be me.
No, that'll be
me. Oh, thank you.
I wanted to see.
Thank
you. I have to look it up.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's been a crazy life.
But you wouldn't trade it for anything.
No, not for the world. It's been blessed.
After the accident, whenever the next time that you wrestled and you had to come out of the rafters, how hard was that? What were you thinking?
Oh my gosh, they made this whole platform, right, with candelabra, baby grand piano, curtains, everything. This whole contraption to come out of the rafters when I was playing the piano, and I had to out. You know, I was legitimately playing the piano. Matter of fact, I worked with Jimmy Hart on the sheet music to play for the music, right? Because him and I were like pretty much the only two that knew anything about music at the time. And, you know, he played with Derringer and all that. He has a great musical background, and we both used to be involved with Memphis Wrestling Territory, right? So it was really cool that we were both happy that we got to work together, but. I'm coming down the rafters, right? And during back then to the Nitros, I mean, they would pack the arena, so they would drown out the sound. So I had really kicking the bass of the piano to really jam the keys to get the sound going, right? Because, I mean, the crowd noise was just deafening during that time. It was like middle of the Monday Night Wars and everything, too, with WCW, WWE, and, of course, you know, ECW at the time. And so, it was a big time for wrestling. So it's like But yeah, those arenas were a pack full of people. So I really kicked in that bass and jam out those keys to get the music across.
I'll bet. I mean, I'm sure it was a blast. Yeah.
And every time I look down, people look like ants. So I try not to look down as much when I'm playing, right? Because every time I look down, I'm like, oh my god, I'm way up in the freaking air.
By the way, Papa, I've never asked this question. What was the first song that you played when you came down? Do you remember?
Oh, first song. Well, they just had me play some random stuff in the beginning. So I was playing a little bit of Mozart, Beethoven. You know what I mean? Classical style piano, right? And then when I got to the theme music, which actually it was like the piano version of Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff's music. At the time, so Paul Orndorff and I will be forever connected.
Yeah, you're forever connected with the greatest wrestlers in history during the heyday of wrestling, which probably started from when I was in high school up through your entire career. That's truly the heyday of wrestling, and we talk about it every week, don't we? Pardon?
That's how I got to be the maestro because of my theatrical background. I used to be in theater, right? So I was in Cats on the Broadway. I was Cats on Broadway. You remember the play Cats? I was Alice in Wonderland. I was the king that got betrayed, Macbeth. The Dodo Bird and Alice in Wonderland. Yeah, go figure.
Wow. That's great. Yeah, you were You certainly were the maestro. You still are the maestro. Somebody else can be the maestro quite like you can, and that's wonderful.
Exactly.
And so, and you know, we appreciate you being on here. I am going to be going down to Atlanta before the beginning of the year, and I'll see if I can't get some of that information on through the Freedom of Information Act. I don't know how long it'll take, but when I do, I will round up with this crew right here, Papa Stro, Robin and Tony, and we will see what we can find out from that, and we'll jointly put together a show. I think that would be quite, it'd be quite interesting. It's not exactly what folks would be ready for, but we'll find out. And we've got a recording here, obviously, of our questions, and I will listen to it again and kind of jot down some of the open-ended things that we discussed and see if we can find those answers in the police records and in the autopsy reports, unless, of course, they've been sealed by a judge. Don't know if they have been or not. Maybe they have, but, you know, we'll see. And also, I can check with some of the reporters in Fayetteville, Georgia. I can tell you that you can't get a hold of any reporters from the Atlanta Constitution. You just can't. So, excuse me. Trying not to get sick here with Thanksgiving coming upon us. But anyway, thanks a lot, everybody. It's been a great Murder 1-2-3. Now, as Papa Stro taught me to do, we all have to do our plugs. We got about 60 seconds per person. So I'll start with Tony, whatever you want to plug. Robin, whatever you want to plug. Papa Stro, whatever you want to plug. And then we'll sail on into the sunset for next week on Murder 1-2-3. So we'll start. Tony, what have you got to plug in 60 seconds?
Well, I would like for everybody to come visit us on CryptoCrew.com and check out the Crypto Watch on YouTube, and also check us out on Amazon Prime. So just go. We have several films out. Most of them have to do with historical and unexplained. So check us out on Prime.
All right, we will do that. And Tony, thank you for being with us on the Cell Block. And
take care, Tony.
And staying with us.
Thank you, Tony.
Robin, what have you got
thank
to plug
you
here? Absolutely.
Same thing I always plug. I mean, I'm really pushing hot and heavy on the Hominology Project, the International Hominology of the Forest People on Facebook. We've got our page up. We're just starting to get things cranking right now. And as always, Sasquatch Genome Project, Dr. Melba Ketchum. So some great things were done there that really just need to be acknowledged. Nobody else has been able to do it since she did it. So those two things.
Sounds great. And I've got, I've got a couple of samples. I'm going to try to get to her if we can ever get some funding to test them out, but I've got them right over here in my bookcase. So thanks a lot, Robin.
Good.
It's always great to have you. Always great to have Tony. Papa Stro, this is one of the few times I get to say, and what do you have to plug tonight?
Well, I'll be part of the In the Room podcast tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm going to have a special Thanksgiving WCW Retro Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, also on VOCNation.com. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday after Thanksgiving, I'm going to be with the artist known as the Sheikster at the Parts Unknown table for the WrestleCade weekend at the Benton Convention Center in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Star-studded, packed, three-day event. And for more info on that, go to WrestleCade.com. And my official website is thestro.com for all the ladies on TV, wrestling, film, and merchandise. So check me out there and all my social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. I'm on all those. So.
Wonderful.
But, thank you for having me.
Hey, Stro, yeah, that's great because it just happens to turn out that on Sunday, Charleston Caricature. British lady. Charleston Caricatures will be in Winston-Salem at the Camel City Vintage Toy and Comic Book Show. So maybe we can round up after the show, after our two shows. I'll make it a point to give you a call on Sunday and see what your schedule's like. How's that?
Fantastic. That'd be great.
Oh yeah, it would. We just happen to both be in Winston-Salem as we travel the world doing what we love to do. So again, thank you, Papa Stro.
Yeah, right.
This has truly been one of the most incredible shows I have ever hosted. And by the way, Papa Stro, you're the guy that got me in the podcasting business anyway. So thanks to you for that. And And he did. Absolutely he did. I'll tell the story next time that we have him on here, because as soon as I get the information on that autopsy and everything, we're going to be rounding back up. So thank you, Robin. Thank you, Tony. Thank you, Papa Stroh. We'll see everybody next Monday night, 10 p.m. Eastern. Our guest will be Tony Filosa about all the going on in Harlan, Kentucky. So thanks a lot, everybody.
Good night.
God bless. Have a safe and wonderful Thanksgiving. Cheers.
Good night,
Take
everybody.
Care. Bye.
Bye.